Mike Malevsky here, and it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Shelley Hughes. Welcome, Shelley.
Thank you. It's good to be here with you, Mike.
Shelley is running for the Alaska State Senate, and we're going to ask a set of generalized questions and then leave opportunity for some comments if she has them. We are focusing in this interview on an invitation to identify your own purpose for running as you think about the topics that we'll be talking about. That seems to be important to listeners, people who are making a decision. So the first question is, how do you see yourself working with others serving in the Alaska State Legislature?
Mike, perhaps you already should have asked you maybe before we went on air. Have you explained before we answer that first great question as far as what this, which district this is and the...
Sure. If you want to identify that, that's fine.
It is Senate seat F, as in friends and family, and it includes House District 11 and House District 12. House District 11 is the one I've been serving the last few years. The Greater Palmer area includes Lazy Mountain and goes up to Seward Meridian, up to Palmer Fishhook. And then 12 goes on across the highway to includes Fairview Loop up to KGB. Also extends out to the Butte. Mm-hmm. And then kind of goes on south of the borough into the municipality of Anchorage and includes Eklutna, Peters Creek, Chugiak area. So that is Senate seat F for friends and family, just so folks know that.
Okay. Now, how do you see yourself working with others that are serving in the Alaska State Legislature?
I see a continuation of what I have worked very, very hard to do, and that is to work with every single person in the legislature. You know, there's 40 in the House, 20 in the Senate. And I think in one aspect or another, I've pretty much worked with everyone, whether it's been on a bill or a budget item in one capacity or another, whether it's been a Republican, a Democrat, or we did have an independent down there. I know I worked with Dan Ortez at one point regarding something about one of his communities near the border, had to do with the highway and transportation. And so I think I've worked with all of them. And I'm proud to say as well that all my legislation that has passed and been successful has had bipartisan support. And I do that. You know, I am a conservative. I'm not shy about that. And I know there's folks along different points along that spectrum. And I have been able to be successful building consensus and achieving solutions without forsaking my conservative values, but getting others from across that political spectrum to join in. And so I'm proud of that. And so I expect, you know, I have a proven track record of doing that, and it's going to be very important to continue that. And so I look forward to it.
Okay. Second question. What is your perspective on the way the legislature functions currently? And along with that, if you believe there should be some changes, we're talking about the operational characteristics of the legislature as a body. What would you propose? And along that way, complete it. What's your opinion of coalitions?
Okay, you know, I have discussed one change that I think we should consider, and that is moving. And I know a lot of people, I know the legislators don't agree with me, but I still think it's worth considering, and maybe we could get bits and pieces out of it, is doing the budget on every other year. So you have 2 years to work on it, and you pass the budget in the first year of the two-year cycle. And that way, if there are tough decisions that need to be made, it puts it in an off-election year, which can be helpful, particularly to the House members who run every 2 years. It also would allow legislators to get in the weeds a little bit more when you're talking about billions of dollars. it's really hard in a few months period down in Juneau to really find out everything you need to know and to do a good job. So that is something, some states do that. I think that is worth considering. I also think that we should really seriously look at the ICER sustainable amount and then priority budget. So you basically have a certain dollar amount and then you start plugging in the priorities, the essential services, and see where you get and budget that way. We've done it a little bit differently with the governor giving us a budget in mid-December and then working off of that. But I think priority-based budgeting would be a good way, particularly during this time. And then another process thing, Mike, that I have mentioned, I don't know that any of the finance co-chairs are interested in it, but in the subcommittee process, and just so listeners know, you have the members on the finance committee, and each of those folks, before they get in heavily into the budget, early in the session, they each chair subcommittees for the various departments. And so the rest of the members of the legislature who are not on the finance committee, they will serve on these individual subcommittees. That process is gives that finance subcommittee chair a chance to develop that department's budget and work on it and look into the weeds a little bit and then bring it back to the full committee. That right now, that process is not, it's noticed, but it's not technically on the public record. We don't have secretaries taking notes. It's not televised on gavel to gavel. I know, I realize there would be a bit of a cost to have those secretaries and to have it taken up a notch. But I think that would improve the process. I believe that legislators would be more engaged and be working harder to find out the information and propose adjustments, reductions, changes. Right now, from my observation, from having been in a few years, most of the work rests on the finance subcommittee chair, and the members around the table aren't as engaged as I'd like to see. I was very, very engaged working with each of the chairs. And there were some other legislators who, like me, were very engaged, but a lot of people were maybe just showing up or maybe not even showing up. And I think if we took it up a notch and we're on the public record, I think we'd have a better process. So that's another thing. I've got one more, if I've got time for that. And I believe that the legislature overall, we need to be better communicators. It seems that we leave the communication to the media outlets, the various stations, and, you know, that's their job to report the news. But sometimes things get lost in translation, and it almost at times seems that the media becomes another branch of government, so to speak. In other words, they're crafting the message and often the agenda. And we've left that void in many ways, I think. I think if we could communicate better what is happening and the work that's going on directly from the legislature, I think it would improve the process. I think it would improve engagement with Alaskans. I think they'd be better informed and they would be reaching out to us in a greater way too if they really knew what's happening. So, and one of the things I did, you know, I was making all kinds of videos from down in Juneau, and people were really appreciative of that because it was coming directly from somebody who had been in the room, had heard the discussions as opposed to third hand. Mm-hmm. So I think that I would like to see an improvement in communication.
So the third part of the question was
on coalitions.
What is your opinion of coalitions?
You know, we have had coalitions. Well, I haven't looked back historically since statehood to see if there've ever been a time when your majority minority were purely just folks in one part or the other, perhaps. But since I've been in, we've had Democrats in the majority, and we've had moderate Republicans in the majority, and conservative Republicans in the majority. In some states, those moderate Republicans might have been an actual moderate Republican party. So it really is quite the spectrum already that we have had in the House the last few years. And we didn't really call it a coalition. It wasn't called that, but it essentially was. And I think coalitions work well. You do have to kind of pick and prioritize and decide where you're heading and have a target. And if you have something is perhaps that there was back a few years ago, they called it the bipartisan coalition in the Senate, and perhaps the numbers were more even than what we, half and half than what we've had, for instance, in the House, where it was a smaller number of Democrats. But whatever the coalition makeup is there's always going to be a target and priorities, and it's going to be at some point along that political spectrum. And, I had a conversation with someone that, we need to be in the middle, and that's what's so great about a bipartisan coalition. And I'm all for working together. But if you're in the middle, you're picking a certain target, you're picking certain priorities, and that's fine. But that is a place on the political spectrum, just as if the Democrats were in the majority and had a spot way to the left of that, or if the Republicans were in the majority and had a spot way to the right of that. It is a position. It is a stand. So just because it's in the middle doesn't necessarily make it better. It is a particular direction and priority and set of positions. So is one better than the other? It depends where you are on the spectrum if you think that. So I know a lot of people that we have a lot of undeclared nonpartisans in this state, and but yet many of them are at some point on that political spectrum.
Okay. Well, that the natural lead in to the third question, which has a couple of parts. How do you view your relationship with political parties, and do you view political parties or ideology as influences either hampering or facilitating the work of the legislature?
Good question. First of all, I'm known to be a thorn in the side of leadership. I have known to stand up against the party, even my party, to stand up against the administration. I'm not shy in that regard. I call a spade a spade. So very independent in that way. Having said that, I will say that parties are made up of people. They are made up of Alaskans. And I don't want to dismiss the hard work on whether it's the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, the Libertarian Party, because of those people, those Alaskans, those members, they spend a lot of time debating issues, coming up with resolutions where they labor over every single word to get it right and to represent what they as Alaskans feel. And I don't want to dismiss that. On the other hand, I understand politics. And so I think that when you go back to the platforms, you got to think for me, who I am and what I believe in. So if they're in line with the platform, I'm fine. I'm good with that. But they don't, party doesn't control me, I guess you would say. And I think there's good to be learned from the various groups, whether it's a political party or an organization with particular thoughts and positions and priorities. I learn from them. In fact, Mike, this may seem odd to your listeners, but I find it really, really helpful, almost more helpful for me to talk to someone who perhaps we're not coming from the same perspective and they have take different positions. I really like to have that time so I can better understand, because I often find that there are things that perhaps both the person I'm speaking with and myself, we find there's something that we do agree with, and there is a way to move forward on something that maybe we thought was impossible. So I take those challenges and being and listening with people that don't agree with me as some of the most important conversations I have and the input that I need to hear.
Well, and that leads naturally into our last question, number four. How do you reach constituents, especially those feeling out of the public policy conversation, or those that may feel disenfranchised, or even those who will vote for your opponent?
Well, first I want to say that I represent, have worked hard to represent all the residents of the current district that I'm serving, whether they vote or don't vote, whether they're aligned with me or not aligned with me. I really work hard to be there for all the residents and assist when we can. Sometimes we can help them if they're running into roadblocks with, in some regard, with the state or one of the agencies, but also to be listening to their input through the process and the decision-making process. And so I don't just represent the people that agree with me. I represent all of them. So I just want to make that point. As far as those that maybe have felt disenfranchised, I have noticed, of course, this is a presidential year, so a lot more out there. In fact, I think everybody's eager for November 8th to come and go. But I think a lot more people are engaged. I've seen it ramp up. You know, a long time ago, it was 2003 and a little bit of four, just it wasn't even a full 2 years. I did a little bit of legislative aid work briefly in district, but one of it was during session. The amount of contacts and input that we get now, because I did the constituent relations back then, it is exponential. And it's because of, I believe, social media. It's just a lot of more people are aware. They're hearing about topics. They're weighing in. The number of contacts that I receive is incredible, in the hundreds on a daily basis, if you factor in emails, phone calls, and social email where people are specifically reaching out to me. And it's good. It's good. It's a little hard to keep up with, but it's really good. And I do think that there are fewer that are disengaged as a result. And I have coffees where I invite people to come and looking, we'll see what happens. But I'm hoping to have looking at a coffee, one on a Saturday and one on a Friday to accommodate those who work in December. And then an evening town hall in January, if the voters choose to hire me for this position. And those kind of opportunities, I've had many people who have told me they've never interacted with any kind of elected official, and this is their first time, but that's happening a lot. And so I think more and more people are getting involved. And did I answer the full question, or was there another part of it?
There's one last part of it, which involves actually how you deal with the issue of your own conscience and your constituents' concerns, which may have a different perspective.
Right. I work to be an open book and speak what I believe is, where I stand so people know, and I don't hide that. And so during the process while I've been serving and during campaign too, people really hear where I'm coming from. And so if then I am voted in as I was earlier in 2012 and 14, when I go to make decisions in Juneau and I'm picking which button to press, I'm starting from that point that people heard about when they voted for me, right? And then I'm attending committee meetings. I'm reading massive amounts of materials. I'm talking to various experts on the issues. I'm doing research. And then I make my decision. And my thinking is, if the majority of folks in the district that chose to put me in the seat were sitting where I was and hearing what I was in the committee meetings, reading the same materials, doing the research, speaking to the experts, that the vast majority of them would come up with the same conclusion that I would. And that's about the best we can do. So my conscience, I think how I vote, it does align with the folks for the most part. Now, there was one bill where there was so much misinformation out there, and there are some fixes that need to happen to it. And that was SB 91, the criminal justice bill, because I knew that a lot of people in the district were very, very concerned about the increase in crime. And I'm very concerned about the increase in crime. Understood that it was very much related to the increased drug problem. Understanding that heroin is coming up in droves from out of state as now that marijuana is legal, now we have heroin, and which is illegal, and it is also something where about half, I think, of the people getting hooked on heroin, it starts with a prescription from a physician, which is a sad thing as well. So here we have this drug problem, increased crime. And we took the stance, conservatives took the stance a number of years ago to be tough on crime. And we thought that we'd tighten things up and we'd be safer. But what we have found is that crime is getting worse. And so understanding that people still had in the district had this thinking that tough on crime is the best, and my even walking into the legislature with that same mentality, but learning what I did through that process and came to the conclusion that what we are doing is not working, and unless we begin to tackle this drug situation, the crime problem is going to continue to escalate. And so ultimately, I believe that our public safety will increase through criminal justice reform. And that was the toughest vote that I did because at the pace and that we were moving along and some of the misinformation that was circulating and the fact that many back in the district were not in the same seat and hearing the things in the committees and talking to the experts and doing the research, because they didn't have that information, there were a number of folks that weren't with me on that vote. But still, I do believe that had they been exposed to everything that I would, that most of them would have made that conclusion. And I believe ultimately it will increase the public safety, or I would not have voted for it. Now, I do want to say we've seen an upsurge in crime, and people are blaming it on that bill. That bill was implemented. It just went into effect July 1st, but much of it has not even been implemented. You could have, that bill would not have passed, even if that bill would not have passed, your crime would be what it is today, I'm sorry to say. It's just, you know, we haven't, some of the correction aspects, the rehabilitation aspects, they are not happening yet. So it's one of those things that is going to take time. And what I have told people is that, you know, think of the state in the United States that's the toughest on crime. I've asked this of 10, 12 people, and they've all said Texas. And I said, well, that's what we modeled this after. So we want increased public safety. We have to realize that the nonviolent offenders who are have a serious substance abuse problem, when we put them in jail beside hardened criminals that have criminal natures, we are teaching the tricks of the trade to these people that are gentle natured, who do not have criminal natures, and we're turning them into criminals. Our prisons have actually become incubators for hardening criminals. And I worked in the prison system as a contract instructor, and I saw it happening. And you know, when 2/3 of your inmates are returning back to prison with worse offenses within 3 years, we know that what we're doing isn't working. So, and I'll just close out this little segment about the criminal justice bill, Mike, by saying that you can say you lessened the punishment, but here's what I say: if you have a nonviolent offender who steals something, you put them in jail for 6 months, and they're by the pretty scary evil dude that's teaching them stuff, okay? Do you want to do that? Or how about an alternative punishment? Instead of 6 months, we're going to put him on an ankle monitor for 12 months. And we're going to require that he go through substance abuse treatment. We're going to require that he has job training. We're going to require that he gets a job. And we're going to require him to pay restitution. Now, you can say we're letting him off because we're not putting him in jail. But I think the more appropriate and even longer sentence, just because it's not in jail, is actually a better way to help make sure that person will not end up back in jail committing a worse crime. So that's kind of the philosophy. And I understand there are some things that need to be fixed. I know I have had a conversation with former Governor Sean Parnell about some language that we're going to have to go back and address. In fact, I wanted to try to address it this summer, but didn't get enough support to get that moving. So that should come forward this coming year, and those fixes need to occur. Okay. And, you know, the other thing is, no bill is perfect. And if each bill that were passed, Mike, were perfect, we would have only need one state legislature right after statehood, and they could have passed all the perfect bills, and then you wouldn't need a legislature to go back and address statutes. So, yes, we will. These things will be addressed from time to time as we find problems and we see where we can improve them. That's just part of the legislative process.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Representative Shelley Hughes, for coming in and being interviewed as you seek to move from the House to the Senate in the Alaska State Legislature. We have time for a very short comment. Any last comment before we finish?
Well, you know, this has been a really interesting interview because it's all been about the budget, and your questions really are giving listeners a chance to hear kind of a different aspect, and I think that's great. Of course, my goal, because the budget is the first thing we have to address, we do have to get our house in fiscal order. And I was an early advocate 3-4 years ago of the Goldsmith-Eicher, and that we need to use some of the interest off the permanent fund. I believe we should leave the PFDs intact because I believe that that the multiplier for that is worse for the economy. I've also lived out in the villages. Some of your listeners may know I lived in Fort Yukon, lived in Bethel, actually about 12 years in the outlying areas. So I understand that importance. So I'm not a fan of the restructuring and the reductions. I do believe that if we use some of that interest and we bring, even if we bring the budget down to where it was when Tony Knowles exited, when you account for population change and inflation, and depending where we are with oil prices, it's possible we could actually close the gap using that interest. If there's still a gap, and I just want to say, a couple years before Governor Knowles exited, it was $3.3 billion was the unrestricted general spend in today's dollars, and you know, I don't recall people being up in arms that we didn't have adequate services. So healthcare has been a big change in that. So 3.3 might be a little bit difficult because healthcare, in fact, that's one of the things I want to tackle, or healthcare costs, more transparency. I think that will help all Alaskan families. I think it will help our Medicaid budget. It will help paying for our school districts because healthcare is the big driver. So I believe that we can tackle this thing together. I have said that I believe it's a blessing in disguise because we kind of went overboard when those oil prices were high, and we cannot expect, the math, Mike, does not add up to replace the billions lost in oil revenue on the backs of Alaskans. We don't have enough dollars in our pockets to make up for that. So we have to face a new reality. We have to adjust the size and cost of government to what the private sector can afford. And I think that while we do that and we pull together as communities and people get more engaged, I think it's going to be good for our state. It may be a little tough, but we will get through it. It's kind of like when you go on a camping trip with your family, you kind of rough it, but you draw close and it's good. So I don't mean to make light of anyone that's going to be challenged if someone loses a job. You know, I've been there. My husband and I were under the poverty level years ago, and Alaska was a great place to of opportunity to build a life, and I want that to continue for the generation coming up and future generations. And I'll just close by saying that, you know, people ask me why I want to step up to serve. Well, I'm thinking about those future generations, but I also think I have a son and son-in-law who stepped up and put their lives on the line to serve our country and deployed between the two of them more than, 10, 12 times. And I figure if they can step up to do that, the least I can do is step up and serve Senate District F and do the best that I can for our area residents. Well, I just want to thank you, Mike, and thank the listeners who are engaged in listening, getting educated for their decisions on the ballot November 8th. And my cell phone number, if you have any questions, is 907-841-1634, 841-1634. And you can find me on Facebook, Alaskans for Hughes, and website, alaskansforhughes.com. Thanks again.
And thank you, Representative Shelley Hughes.